Welcome to Season 2 and another edition of The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, I'm Linda Chalker Scott, and welcome back to our last podcast of Season 2 of The Informed Gardener. I'm here as your virtual garden advisor, bringing you useful scientific information to use in your own gardener landscape. Every week we try to follow a theme throughout the podcast, and this week's theme is resolutions. During our interview, we'll talk to Dr. Craig Cogger about why you should resolve to maintain your own compost pile next year. And later I'll help you resolve to use that compost wisely and not create a soil or water pollution problem. But first, let's look at resolutions in the news. First, here's a fun one from the UK Mercury Weird Science blog. This one's called Falling Out with the Joneses, and they conducted a survey over 2,000 adults in the United Kingdom and found out that almost 20% of them felt that they had to move because of disputes over home and landscape problems with their neighbors. This would either be they were having a problem with their neighbors' home and garden landscaping, or their neighbors are having a problem with them. The other types of disputes were the ones you expect, maybe like excessive noise or parking spaces or boundary disputes, but the biggest one of all was home and garden problems. My advice is to resolve to avoid problems with your neighbors next year, and instead, why not share something from your garden and maybe you'll have better neighbors. Now the second one is from Science Daily, and it's called Acid Rain Poses a Previously Unrecognized Threat to Great Lakes Sugar Maples. So if you're someone who really enjoys maple syrup with your pancakes or waffles, this will be of interest to you. And I'm going to back up a little bit here. I used to actually teach about acid rain when I was in Buffalo, New York. I did this back in the 90s, and acid rain is a real problem in the eastern part of the United States. We routinely had rain that was somewhere around the 4.2, 4.3 area, of which, if you know pH, realize that's pretty acidic. And you could see the results from this. If you went out and looked at the tombstones in the cemetery, you could actually see that they were etched so badly you couldn't even read the original writing anymore. And that was just from this acidic rain falling over and over and over on these surfaces. So the same thing happens with trees and other plants. You have this rain falling on their leaves, it etches their surfaces, it hurts the leaves, and actually it will also leach things out of the soil, important things like plant nutrients. So we've known for quite a while that we have a problem with acid rain, especially in the eastern part of the country. But this is a new story, and the reason I'm telling it to you is that it actually will have an influence on the compost that you might use in your garden. So, as I mentioned, in Buffalo we had a real problem with acid rain. In Great Lakes region farther inland, they also had the same acid rain problem, but the soils are a little bit more resistant to the acid, so they didn't have the problem with the sugar maples. But recently they have, but it's not from the same problem. It's not from leaching the nutrients, and it's not from etching the leaves. It's a different problem. It turns out, if you don't know about acid rain, that the acid that comes down is from emissions from burning fossil fuels. So things like sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide mix with water in the atmosphere and form sulfuric acid and nitric acid. These are really potent acids. And so when they fall down, they bring their nutrient value along with them. So they're acids, obviously, but they also contain sulfur and nitrogen. Both of those are plant nutrients. It turns out that so much nitric acid is falling and ending up as nitrogen in the soil that we now are getting excessive levels in nitrogen in the soil. So now we have to think about what bacteria and fungi do. If you have a lot of leaf litter, the bacteria and fungi break that down to get nutrients. But now we've added a whole bunch of nitrogen to the soil. And what's happened is that in these particular forests, the leaf litter is accumulating because the microbes aren't breaking it down as quickly. They're getting their nitrogen directly from this acid rain. And this buildup of leaf litter is actually keeping seedlings from the sugar maples from being able to germinate. So you've got a mature forest there. You have the little seeds that come raining down in the fall. And then they're trying to germinate, but they've got this huge barrier of leaves between them and the soil. So they're not germinating, and so the population of sugar maples is actually getting older without recruiting a lot of youngsters. So they're imagining by the end of this century that there may be so few sugar maples left without some kind of intervention that will really have an impact both on the forests and obviously on supply of maple syrup. So this obviously is not good news for sugar maple forests, but there is one good thing about it in terms of what you learn from this, and this is that a very thick layer of leaves is a great way to reduce seed germination. So when you're thinking about your own garden and all those pesky weed seeds that come up in the spring, keep in mind that a thick layer of leaves is going to keep those seeds from germinating. So resolve to mulch well, and you'll have fewer weed problems next year. At the end of the year, many gardeners resolve to start their own compost pile rather than tossing all that good stuff away or putting it in the green waste and then buying bad compost. How silly! So I thought we should visit with Dr. Craig Cogger, who is Washington State University's expert on all things compostable. Well, Craig, it's good to see you back from your long trip, and I'm hoping that you can tell us all about things compostable.
I think one of the questions that people have is, does it still make sense for me to compost at home, because we have a lot of municipal composting operations now? And people really have a choice there. But home composting, one of the benefits to it is that the materials never leave your yard. It's really the ultimate in closing the recycling loop. And at my own house, we have a compost pile. In fact, we have two piles. We have one that's an active one, and then one that sits and cures, and then we use it. And we put into that pile a combination of prunings from our garden, leaves that fall in the yard, and vegetable and fruit scrap types of food waste. And a lot of this food waste are things that originally began in the garden and then wind up through the compost pile back into the garden. We know that for composting to be successful, there's four elements that we need. We need green materials. That's the fresh type of material, which would be your vegetable scraps, etc., that have a lot of sugars in them. They have some starches in them, and they're going to break down very readily. They're going to be what gets the pile going. And then we also have the brown material, which are things like woodier materials. It could be leaves. It could be dried weeds that you're putting into the pile, some small twigs. And what these do is they provide some structure to the pile so we can get a little bit of air into it. And so air is the third agent. And then the fourth is water. We need enough moisture in there so that the microbes that are going to be breaking down the materials have the ability to swim around, to find food, and not get dehydrated. So we have green, brown, air, and water. Now, if you have these set up just right, you can compost hot, and you can get temperatures in your pile rising to 130 to 150 degrees, even maybe even a little bit more than that. This is what we call active composting, and if you're really into active composting, you would also need to turn your pile periodically to get material on the outside into the pile so that it gets into the hot part of the pile. And if composting is a really big hobby for you, you can be an active composter at home. Most folks find they wind up more like me, and they're more passive composters, where I'm continually adding materials at the top. I don't have kind of enough volume or enough of the right mix at once to get a really hot pile, so we call this cold composting. And there's nothing wrong with that as long as we keep certain things out of the pile. Cold composting of manure is not a good idea because it takes a long time to kill the pathogens in the manure. And if you have a lot of weeds that have gone to seed, cold composting is not the best idea for those either. And you might want to put those in your yard debris bin and let the professionals with the hot composting take care of them. But all other materials work fine with a slow method. You know, expect it's going to take 6, 8, 9 months or more, maybe even a whole year. And then when you're done with the home composting process, it's still not going to look like the compost that we get, you know, back from the commercial operations that we're paying money for. And that's because they've run it through a screen. Now, if you want, you can run it through a screen to make it look pretty. But I just dig mine back into the garden where it's going to continue breaking down. So I take it remnants of sticks and remnants of things that haven't fully broken down and all, and turn it back into the garden. And it's a good way it's a good way to recycle and to get the benefits of that organic matter back in the garden.
Now, I'll admit that we don't have our own compost pile, but we had a vermicompost bin, a little one that I bought my husband several years ago, and then it went bad and the worms all died, and we haven't gotten around to putting it back together. And I'm wondering, is that something that's a good alternative, especially if you don't have a lot of space, or is vermicomposting a fad?
You know, I think vermicomposting is a good alternative. It's something that I have not tried myself, although after a recent trip to the Dominican Republic, seeing a number of small-scale vermicomposting operations there, I'm getting ready to set one up at my own house. But vermicomposting really fits in well with a household type of situation. And the reason is we predominantly vermicompost food waste, and you put in shredded paper as a bedding for the worms, and then add the food, and they will, what the worms do is basically they're engineers, and they're going to be churning this pile of food and paper. They're going to be consuming it, passing it through their bodies, and they're kind of like cows in some ways. It's the microbes in their bodies that are going to be breaking down the organic matter that we have in the food waste, that we have in the paper, and then microbes that they excrete. And a couple of the advantages is, one is the product, the vermicompost, is really nice stuff. It looks like an organic rich soil. It's rich in nutrients. The nutrients are available. You really see a crop response to it. It's also something that we can do on a small scale. And also, the way the worms like it best is to have a little bit added, you know, every day or once a week or twice a week or something like that. So it kind of fits the way that we produce our own, you know, our own wastes. And again, with worm composting, we're going to be looking at vegetable scraps. You know, we're not looking at meat in a situation like that, or fatty types of things. So I'd stick with the vegetable scraps, the fruit type of wastes. You could also put, you know, a little bit of garden waste in there if you want. A lot of folks use shredded paper. You need to use special worms. You can't just dig earthworms from your garden. There are special types of worms, common name red worms, but their natural ecosystem niche is in the litter layer. So they break down litter, say in a forest type of situation. And so those are the types of worms that we would want to use. And you would either have to purchase them, or if you have friends or neighbors who are successful worm composters and their population is exploding, they may be willing to give you some worms to pass them on. And then when your population explodes, your worm population, you can do the same thing. One thing about worms is they're sensitive to temperature. They don't like it too hot, and they don't like it too cold. Fortunately, in the Puget Sound area, too hot is seldom a problem. But in the summertime, you know, if it was outside, you would want it in shady areas. Too cold can be a problem, but if you have a basement, that would work just fine. If you have a garage with, you know, that's a heated garage, that would be fine. And even if you don't, if you have a well-protected, well-insulated place and you're in an urban environment where it doesn't get too cold, as long as they don't, you know, get down to freezing, they will survive. Although below about 55 Fahrenheit, they don't like it very much. Their ideal range is between about 55 and 77.
So now we have all this great compost, whether it's from your compost pile, hot or cold, or from your vermicompost bin. So now what do we do with that great stuff?
Okay, obviously what we want to do with that compost is return it back to our gardens, where it will provide organic matter for the soil and it will provide nutrients for the plants. And I really feel for the home compost, the best place to put that is back in our annual garden. Because when we think about it, that's where we're working the soil the hardest. We are often tilling that soil, which tends to break down organic matter. We're harvesting a lot of those crops, so it's not a more stable situation like a lawn or a landscape bed where we have kind of this natural ecosystem already going. So I like to return it to my vegetable garden. And there's a couple ways you can do that. You can apply it in the spring before you plant, and most people incorporate it, but you could also leave it on top of the soil. Another option is if it's in the fall and it's gotten too late to plant cover crops, you could put your compost on the surface of the soil as a mulch in the fall. Let's say it's getting down to Halloween and you still have areas in your garden you're still harvesting, or some you've just finished up and it's too late to plant cover crops. That would be a great place to put a layer of compost. In the short run, it will help control the weeds. In the long run, the weeds will love the compost. But over the winter time, you know, it will help you a little bit with the weeds, and then you can dig it in the spring. How much to add? You know, on an annual basis, half inch, an inch is probably plenty. We don't want to overdo it, get too much organic matter in that soil. That tends to lead us to higher levels of nutrients. And also, as we exceed a soil's natural organic matter content, the organic matter tends to break down faster. So we're really not gaining all that much from it.
Every week on the podcast, I look forward to answering some of your gardening questions based on the theme of the show. I've focused a lot on compost today, and one of the things you should resolve to do is to use compost wisely, whether you make it yourself or not. One of the cardinal sins, in my opinion, before you plant trees and shrubs, is to work lots and lots of organic matter into the soil before doing your planting. Now, this makes a lot of sense, especially if you have a vegetable garden that you also have in your backyard. You know that before you plant your seeds, that you work lots of organic matter into the soil to enrich it before you get those little seeds started. But the problem is that your trees and shrubs are not the same thing as your vegetable garden. So what we need to do in this case is figure out what you have first in your soil before you add anything to it at all. And the way you do this is to get a soil test. And you've heard me talk about soil tests before, but we're going to talk about them again. Now, adding a whole bunch of compost to your soil before you do a soil test is kind of like going to a vitamin supplement store and buying one of everything and taking it home and taking them all. Well, you probably wouldn't do this, and you really shouldn't do it to your soil either. What you probably do before buying supplements is find out what you need. So you have a blood test done or some kind of diagnosis by your doctor who then says, well, you need a little bit more iron or whatever it is. Soil tests will do the very same thing, and then you know exactly what you need to add. So you also need to know, what does your climate normally support in terms of organic matter in the soil? And this gets into soil chemistry, what we don't want to worry about too much, but just be aware that soils for landscape trees and shrubs probably have somewhere between 5 and 10% organic matter in them. That's perfect for growing trees and shrubs. A soil test will tell you exactly what you have. So if you want to grow trees and shrubs and your soil test says you have between 5 and 10%, you're set to go. It turns out that for most of us, we have at least 5 to 10%, and sometimes we have much more than 5 to 10%. So then if we take a whole bunch of compost and work it into the soil, then you've upped it even more, and you're getting it up to levels that are going to cause problems. And there's three different things that will happen if you add too much organic amendment. The first thing is you cause a disruption of what's called soil hydrology, and that just means the ability of water to move from place to place within the soil. If you have in your planting area a whole bunch of organic matter and all the surrounding soil doesn't have as much, water is going to get stopped up every time it tries to cross that difference in organic matter. It's because the soil texture is not the same. And you can demonstrate soil hydrology with a sponge, and then you'll kind of understand how this works. If you take a sponge and you drip water onto it, the water is absorbed by the sponge, and it doesn't just run out the bottom. In fact, it won't start running out the bottom of the sponge until the sponge is so full of water and so heavy that finally gravity kind of presses it through. And that's the same thing that happens if you have overly amended soil in your landscape. The water will just sit there, and finally it'll move through, but it will be very, very soggy by the time it finally moves. So you don't want soggy soil, so you don't put a lot of organic into the soil if you don't need it. The second thing that happens is you get what's called subsidence, and this is when the soil actually sinks. Now, the thing about organic matter is it's organic, and organic matter breaks down. So the more organic matter you have, the more stuff is going to break down, leaving nothing. And so all the soil particles, the silt and the sand and the clay, is going to kind of sink and settle to fill up those voids where the organic matter used to be. So your whole soil bed sinks over time if you have too much organic matter in there. The third thing that happens, and I want you to think back to the acid rain story I told you, is that you're going to have what's called nutrient overload. because all that organic matter contains all kinds of great nutrients. Great if you don't have too much of it. If you put in too much compost, you're going to have too much nitrogen, too much phosphorus, too much sulfur, too much of everything. And you can have those very same problems where you start interfering with the ability of your microbes to break down the compost or the mulch or whatever you have on there because you've got too many nutrients in the soil. So what you should do is use your compost as a top dressing. In other words, you use it as a mulch rather than work in the soil. And if you're a cheap and lazy gardener, kind of like I am, you want nature to do the work for you. So you put the mulch on top, which could be the compost, could be wood chips, and then you let nature work in the soil. Rainwater takes it through, little earthworms come up and take it through, little bigger moles come up and can take it through, gravity takes it through. So just let nature do the work of incorporating all that great organic matter into your soil. It's a slow feed rather than a fast feed. This podcast is only one of the ways I provide science-based information for use in your own garden. For more, be sure to visit my webpage, TheInformedGardener.com. It's my official Washington State University webpage, and it's full of great and free information. You'll also find archived podcasts from our first season there. Second, please join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professors blog. It's at GardenProfessors.com, and the four of us take turns posting on just about any gardening topic you can imagine. You can even add comments if you feel so inclined. And finally, for those of you who will never give up books until they're pried from your cold, dead hands, I've written three books that might be of interest: The Informed Gardener, The Informed Gardener Blooms Again, and Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. You can find out more information on all three of these books at sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. In any case, I hope you found this podcast entertaining and useful. I welcome listener comments and questions, and please email me at lindacs@wsu.edu. We'll be back in a few weeks with our spring season. In the meantime, be sure to listen to archived podcasts linked on theinformedgardener.com.